Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 157 with Greg Teagarden from Digital Domain. And I have known Greg for many, many years. He and I worked on many, many projects together and had many conversations. But what's cool about this podcast, what I enjoy about it the most, is that I get to ask questions that are very different. And I got to learn a lot about Greg. And you know what? Besides him being a really good storyteller, he's also got a really interesting past. And, you know, from his, obviously, it's a long time that he's been at Digital Domain, as well as the fact that he was at Amblin before that, where he met Eric Barba, and they were working on Sequest and, you know, the Amiga days and all of this stuff. So he's really, really great conversation with Greg. And I think you guys will enjoy hearing some of his past. But speaking of the podcast, one of the things that I enjoy about the podcast is that, and I'd love to hear more about what you guys enjoy about the podcast. I've been asking a couple times to make sure that you let us know how you feel and what you'd like to hear more of, and or tell us what you're thinking. And so please go to iTunes and make sure you rate us and review us there. I'd really appreciate it. It would be good for us and good for the podcast. Let's see, what other announcements do we have to make? We're kind of between things. I'll be able to announce a few more exciting things in the next week or two. But, for now, I'll tell you that I've been plugging away at, writing a bunch of blog posts, for our site. So if you go to chaoscoop.com and go to the blog section, you'll see there's a little labs area there. And I've been putting some blog posts about some of the new features that are in V-Ray Next that are coming up. So it's in beta right now, as many of you may know. I've been writing a bunch. I've got one that's about to come out, and I got a new one coming out soon. So make sure to go to chaoscoop.com and check out our blog section. There's going to be a bunch of stuff going on there. I'm sure there's stuff that you'd be interested in hearing about. And I will be traveling. This traveling season is starting. I'm probably going to go to Bulgaria in the next few weeks to go visit our friends over there, the mothership. And I'll be talking to Vlado and stuff, and hopefully we can do a podcast with him. He's always a good guest. Vlado's always very popular. I love having him on. Let's see. I think that's about it, guys. Anyway, hopefully you guys will enjoy this great, great podcast with my good friend, Greg Teagarden. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Okay, Greg, how are you doing? Is it good?
I'm doing good.
Yeah? Yeah, you've been busy?
I have been busy.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. So I was actually trying to remember, like, the first, we've known each other for years and years, but we didn't actually work together until I came back to DD.
That's right.
And you were one of the people that were convincing me to do that.
Well, I wanted you at the time because I think it was Julie Miller, I think, who was one of the producers.
Yes.
Digital producers on Tron.
Yes.
Said, hey, I got this guy named Chris Nichols. Uh-huh. Because I kept saying I need somebody who.
Wasn't Miller.
It wasn't Julie, was it?
It was Julie, but her last name wasn't Miller. Julie Miller is the publicist.
It was Julie.
Julie something else though.
It was Julie something else.
Oh, well.
Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yes.
Julie. So Julie says to me.
Yeah.
You know, she says, I know you're looking for somebody who knows Maya and knows V-Ray, and that was kind of a hard.
At the time, it was
a hard thing to find because there were tons of V-Ray Max users out there,
yep.
But there weren't any V-Ray Maya users.
Right.
And so I remember I called you and you came over.
Yeah.
And I remember we walked over to the firehouse.
No, we went to, you took me out to lunch at, what's the.
Or was it the Rose, or no, was it the Rose Cafe?
No. It was the Shia.
Oh, okay.
We went to Chire.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I had.
So to you were really buttering me up.
I was really buttering you up. That's right. I was really buttering you up. I got an expense account on that one.
Chire is great. Yeah, we went to Chire, and you were like telling us, like, all right, so here's the situation. And I think Eric Barbo was also interested. He was on set at that point. And I was like, what are we going to do on this? Because I guess at the time you were just thinking of using V-Ray for the environments.
Correct.
Right. And I was a VFX soup at Method at the time when I was working on commercials over there. And I said, you know, I really, this is a beautiful, beautiful project. I really kind of like, if I'm going to get back into features, this is the one I want to do it on. And I was very interested. And I didn't really care necessarily about, you know, making sure that I was a supervisor here or there or staying a supervisor at Method or whatever. I just want to make sure I could work on a really cool project. I was compensated fairly and I could do some fun stuff. And so you and I got together and I was like, I think this is going to be great. Greg's a really nice guy. He seems really level-headed. He's just not egotistical at all. And I was very excited to work on a project. And then slowly as I got involved, you and I were starting to work things out and we're like, within like a week, it's like, the scope is expanding.
Well, that was because remember they were using a different renderer at the time.
You can talk about it now because it's actually a defunct render. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, Mental Ray is officially done.
Wow.
They're no longer making Mental Ray.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, they were like Mental Ray was something that they were trying at DD to use for years.
Right.
And
successfully and did well. And,
yeah, I mean the Mental Ray's Achilles heel was always its motion blur.
Right.
And it just took forever to compute. Mm-hmm. And so as long as you didn't have to render that, it was fine.
Or you could do it with vectors.
Or you could do it with vectors. But then the problem that we had, I remember, was that when it came to the light bike sequence, which your sequence became, that it's like, okay, how are we going to render all of these reflections with motion blur? With
correct motion
blur. Correct motion blur. Right. Exactly. And then refractions and also through all the multiple layers of glass that made up the stadium for light bike. And I remember that the Mental Ray advocates at the time were saying, well, we'll just do all these, we'll render motion vectors into the glass and we'll do all this stuff. And then it was said, well, then what happens? It says, well, we're going to give it all to Comp and they'll figure it out. And remember, Comp was just like, no. We're not doing that.
Right.
And then we were able to demonstrate that we could render all the stuff basically for free.
Yeah.
So to speak, in one pass. Yeah. And it was just an easy, I think that was when the call was made. It's like, all right, guys, I think that this is what we need to do.
Yeah. And then slowly, slowly, sequence by sequence, it started becoming more and more V-Ray. And that was one of the biggest jumps happened at that time. Mm-hmm. And it was cool because you and I were really sort of trying to be as analytical and as politically neutral as possible. It's like, it's going to be faster this
way. Right. And it was.
Yeah. It was interesting. It was, and you and I spent a lot of late nights on that project. I like that.
I wore my.
You wore your light light jet. It's the wrong sequence.
I know. I was thinking about that this morning, but I don't have my light bike shirt has long since fallen apart.
So, oh really? Yeah. Well, you've worn it too much.
I've worn it too much. Yeah.
But that was we worked a lot on that. It was I remember spending a lot of time hanging out with you, looking at stuff. It's like, how are we going to get this done? You were in the office with Nikos, I think. Like, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And so you and Nikos and I would
right next to the swamp room.
That's true. Yep. Hang out in your office and every now it's like 8 o'clock. It's like, all right, we got some problems tonight, so we better bring out a little bit of whiskey to figure this out.
Oh, well, we brought out a lot of whiskey.
Yeah, yeah. But it was a lot of fun. In the end, those types of projects are the ones like all the hard times. At the end, you were like, this was a blast. It was a real blast.
Right. Did you know that it was about, so when was it that we were having lunch with Dan? It was about.
That's wrong.
Was that how long? Two weeks ago? So it was 2 weeks ago and one day.
Yes. It was 7 years.
That it was 7 years.
Yes.
That we delivered that
I got show. A little reminder and like by Google Photos or something.
Yeah.
Like 7 years ago and it was us at the waterfront.
Right.
Wow.
Yep.
That's right. Yeah, we had to, and that was quite the rap party. That was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And what was cool about it, I remember there was something that was fun was we were sitting there having, we were like, we're done. We're sitting there having fun, and we're at the waterfront. And they said, oh, and I said, oh, they need us back. They want everyone back in the whale. They have a meeting right now. And we're like, are you kidding me? We just wrapped the show. We don't want to go back to the whale. So they all went back to the whale, and it turns out that they were basically giving us champagne. That was so cool of them. And they gave us those glasses, those 3D glasses that had Tron on them.
And I still have mine.
And I still have mine too. Yeah, it's cool. Yeah, it was a really good show, and Lisa Beru was an amazing producer for Santa.
She was she took such good care of us on that show.
Do you remember
those huge spreads that she used to get for us on
Saturdays?
On Saturdays,
yeah. You know, she says, like, if you're going to work on Saturday, I'm going to treat you right.
Absolutely.
And she would get us she would bring in two masseuses and a chiropractor.
Yep.
And you could schedule like a massage, like little time break to do that. Amazing and really good catering. Yeah. The catering was, I think, I mean, she, in her past life, she was a line producer, so she knew all the best caterers in town.
Yep, and she brought them in.
Yeah, she did. It was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. And then we, but let's go back, because you actually have a long, long history in this industry that goes way back, right?
Way back.
From your, and it started with your dad, I believe. Am I right? Your dad was one of the influences in your...
Well, yeah. I mean, my dad... I mean, going on, if you want to go way back, my dad was originally an interior designer for a large architectural firm in Los Angeles called Welton Beckett Associates.
Oh, okay.
And they did like department store interiors, like Bullock's, Robinson's, stores that are not in existence anymore.
Yep.
And the Broadway, stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And then he got my uncle, so his sister's husband.
Okay.
Or I guess he'd be his brother-in-law.
Right.
Was an art director at Warner Brothers.
Uh-huh.
And he was working on, like, he did Hill Street Blues and stuff like that.
Oh, right.
And so he was working on this new TV series called Super Train.
Okay.
And it was kind of like described as a love boat on wheels. And I think it was NBC's most expensive series that they had ever done.
Really?
Until that point. Yeah.
I've never heard of it.
And yeah, there's a reason for that.
Okay. All right.
And anyway, what they didn't have, though, was a design for the train itself.
Okay.
So my uncle, you know, knowing that my dad had an industrial design background because he was an Art Center graduate.
Oh, your dad was?
My dad was, yeah.
So
he was, he was in Art Center when Sid Mead was there, actually.
Oh, really?
Sid Mead was either a year in front or a year behind him.
Oh, nice. I've met Sid Mead.
But yeah. And so anyway, he asked my father to help design this train.
Okay.
So my dad did some sketches.
For the interior of it, I'm assuming.
For the exterior.
Oh, exterior. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because they didn't even have that. And so my dad did some stuff. And so, you know, my uncle takes it in and the director, and or I should say the showrunner. I don't know what they call him.
Showrunner, I think. Yeah.
Said, hey, this is pretty great. Let's see if we can get, if he can do some more drawings. So my dad started drawing up the interiors and eventually what the problem was is that it was getting in the way of his regular day job.
Sure.
And so they gave him some time off, and then he kept designing this stuff, and eventually they hired him on the show.
Right.
And that was how he got into the business.
Interesting.
And so then, but of course at the time I was probably like, I don't know, 11 years old at the time or mm-hmm. whatever. And so fast forward a number of years, he's now been in the business for a while.
Yeah.
And eventually he gets he's the art director on Jurassic Park.
Right.
And he gets me a job as a set designer doing AutoCAD
How old were you?
I was 25 at the time.
Okay.
Or 26.
Okay.
And so I did that for a little while. And then after that.
So you were one of the first, like, I guess you were on the art department at that time.
I was art department. Yeah. Right. So I would have been pre-production.
Right.
So so we were on the back lot of Universal. You know, we were
did
in the
ambulance. Did you know Stefan?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Stefan. Yeah. He was a storyboard artist, but he was using Lightwave.
Okay.
Do storyboards. And in fact, I share an office with him.
Do you want to hear a small world story?
Sure.
He is married to another art director who I went to architecture school with.
Wow. Yeah. Stefan was really good. I mean, he eventually went on to become an art director himself
Oh yeah. He was the creative director on, the King Kong movie.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But he did I remember in the office when I was working at the time, I was a set designer, he was doing basically what would become animatics, like what we would describe as previs today.
Yep.
Is what he was doing back then, but we didn't know what to call it. I think we just called them like moving storyboards.
Right.
And so he did the sequence where the T-Rex is on the road and it basically breaks out of the paddock and turns the kids Ford Explorer upside down.
Right.
And so he classic had all that. Scene. Yeah. So he had all that stuff like in the computer and they like, and the thing is that Steven liked that because you could, for the first time, you could sort of like
frame it.
You could frame it through a computer camera and you could block out all the animation mm-hmm. or block out not the anime. That's what we do today. But back then block out the action,
the framing
yeah. of everything and get the timing down, get the beats down. Mm-hmm. And then he would then cut that into his edit. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was back in 1991, I think, or 92.
Yes, it came out in 93 is when yeah. the movie came out. So probably 91.
So yeah. So that was, I did that for 3 months. It was basically a summer job.
Uh-huh.
And then I was done. I designed a few sets and I think my big claim to fame was the gates of the park and the electric fences and the electric utility shed that Laura Dern runs into.
Right.
But I just did the exterior. I didn't do the interior.
So you designed it in AutoCAD.
In AutoCAD, yeah.
So how did you learn AutoCAD? Just like, I'm just going to pick it up and learn it?
I learned that at community college.
Really?
Moore Park Community College is where I learned that.
Oh, okay. Well, good enough to do that.
So, you know, but anyway, I got my foot in the door for that right. type of thing. But then I needed another job after that.
Uh-huh.
And so my dad knew a production designer by the name of Richard Lewis.
Okay.
Who was working on a television series that was new at the time that was called Sequest. There and he needed a set designer. So mm-hmm. I brought all my stuff over. He looked at all of my nice architectural Jurassic Park drawings. And he said, yeah, this is not really what I need. I'm looking for somebody with more of a vehicle design background.
Right.
And so he showed me all these really cool drawings that their art director named James Lima had done.
Mm-hmm.
And then he showed me this rendering of the Sequest submarine.
Okay.
And at the time I was a 3D studio 2.0 enthusiast. That was like my hobby at home type thing. I didn't know what to do with this because no one was using this stuff.
Right.
I just thought of myself as an AutoCAD set designer guy.
Yeah.
And so I asked him, I said, hey, you know, would it be possible if I could just like come in and watch your guys work so I could pick up a couple things? And he goes, absolutely not. And he says, but you might be able to get a job doing it. And okay. the reason for this, that he put that out there, is because back then there wasn't anybody who knew how to do this kind of stuff. It was a very, very, very small pool.
Uh-huh.
And if you knew how to turn on a computer, push a mouse, and you had any artistic inclination, they would be willing to give you a shot.
Interesting. And yeah, that was the way it was back then.
Yeah.
And that's why there were so many people in the early days that came from all kinds of backgrounds, because there was no...
Right, exactly.
There was no real degree that you can get. Now you can get a specific yeah. degree in modeling if you wanted to.
Yeah, but, no, I mean, there was nothing back right, then. Yeah. So he introduced me to a guy named Joe Conti, who was the visual effects supervisor of the mm-hmm. show. And Joe gave me a drawing of a little underwater submarine that was called the Stinger. We used to... it was like this little craft that had this funny little... It looked like a tadpole.
Okay.
And he said, here, take this thing home and build the model over, you know, and then and this was like on a Friday.
Okay.
And so he says, you know, take it home, spend some time on it this weekend, show it to me next week and I'll let you know what I think.
Okay.
I'm like, great. So I take this thing home and I boot up 3D Studio mm-hmm. and I must have built this thing 20 times.
Really?
Because the modeling tools were very crude back then.
Yeah.
And I wasn't like any kind of an expert modeler by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. So I finally put something together by like Sunday night that I was more or less kind of happy with.
Right.
I put it on it was a 3.5-inch floppy disk.
Yeah.
Because that's what they had back then.
Yeah.
And took it into, drove it into Universal Studios on Monday, gave it to them. And then I didn't hear anything back for like 2 days. And I thought, oh, okay, I'm probably not going to get this job.
Right.
And then they call me back and they say, hey, we'd like you to come in.
Okay.
So I come in and he says, yeah, we've got a position open for a modeler.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be building submarines and underwater craft. It's probably going to be like a 6-month gig. And, you know, if you're interested, we'd like to hire you. And I'm like, let's do it.
Right.
And that
awesome.
Went on for, that's where I actually met Richard Payne for the first time.
Uh-huh.
Because he was my, uh, he was the guy who was I shared an office with, and he was already hired.
Oh, okay.
So he's actually the one who I learned a lot of my modeling skills from in the early days.
Yeah, I love Dickie.
And awesome. Yeah, he's a great guy. and so, you know, he taught me a lot of stuff. And then another guy named Tony Stutterheim was there at the time.
Uh-huh.
And Eric Barber was eventually hired.
Yeah.
At that point, he came in about a month later.
Yeah, Eric was on the podcast, and he told me his story about how he was an SGI salesman.
He was an SGI salesman. Well, he wasn't an SGI salesman. He was an Alias salesman.
Right.
That's what they, yeah, he was selling Alias software at the time, and they set him up in the room next to me, and he was building, I remember he was building an Akula class submarine.
Okay.
And we had struggled with this thing because it had a lot of, it wasn't just a like your typical, like, you know, round tube type submarine. I remember it had like this, it had like a flat tail, and it had specific little molded shapes where the screws would attach, right, or propellers, or technically they called them screws. But he like kind of knocked this thing out pretty fast using splines, and we didn't have splines really at the time in Lightwave. And so,
You were using Lightwave.
Yeah. We were using Lightwave at the time. And so, I remember I walked into his office and said, "How's it going?" And he says, and he just looks at me and he goes, "Little by little, step by step." And so eventually what happened was they hired then him, and then we all sort of became this group.
Right.
And this went on for 2.5-3 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then after that, it was just, you know, that's where we kind of all cut our teeth, so to speak, in this kind of business, because, you know, like I said, there weren't a lot of people who knew how to do it back then. And right, if you had any desire or tenacity, it took a lot of tenacity back then, because there wasn't like, you couldn't just go ask somebody, "Hey, how do I do this?"
Right.
Because they didn't know either.
Right.
And so we were all kind of making it up as we went along. And it was very, I remember Joe Conde, our supervisor, used to call us pioneers. He says, we're like pioneers, because no one's ever done this before.
Yeah, but isn't that, I mean, it's less these days, but it's almost always been that way in visual effects, in the sense that
it still is as far as the more complex stuff goes right now, I think.
But
it,
isn't that because, like, I want to see something I've never seen before?
Sure.
Right. So we're always doing something that's never been done before. You're right. That's kind of one of the exciting things about working in the industry, is doing things that have never been done. Like, there's no one like, "Oh, I can just go on a forum and check something out." It's like, no, I'm going to have to invent this from nothing.
Yeah. We would just bounce ideas off each other. "Hey, what if we did this way?" Or, "Hey, what if we did it that way?"
Right.
Like, "Well, that might work," or "That might work," you know, and also nobody knew that there was no thought back then that something couldn't be done. The sort of mindset was that
eventually we'll figure something out.
Eventually we'll figure it out. It's like, yeah, if we approach it from enough different directions all at the same time or in succession, that we'll eventually hit on an angle that works.
Right.
And we did, but I think about now, if I were to try to approach work that way, which I guess I still kind of do, but it seems like it was more like your ignorance is bliss, I guess is a way to describe it, you know,
because, but I still think we have an attitude where, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, because I haven't actually been working on production for a while, but rare, I don't think anyone at Digital Domain would ever say, "We can't do that."
You never would say that.
The only thing you'd say is like, "Given enough time, we'll come up with a solution.
We'll figure it out."
so that's
the old thing is, it's going to look great when it's done.
Yes. It's going to look great when it's done.
That's what we say when we don't know how we're going to get it done. It's just, we all look at each other and go, "It's going to be great."
Yeah. It's going to be great. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so I got introduced to Eric Barba through you.
Yep.
And so it was a very interesting thing, because I had Eric Barba was, you know, famous and infamous, because he was a strong character at DD. Some people liked him.
He was rolling off the backside of Benjamin Button.
Benjamin Button. But so, even before that, when he was still just in commercials, not just in commercials, but he was doing really high-end commercials.
Sure.
And I was in features way back when. I knew of Eric Barba, and, you know,
right,
it's like the really cool stuff is coming out of Eric Barba. So I knew of him, but I never actually worked with him in person. I never even talked to him before you introduced me to him. Mm-hmm. So I was a little, I wouldn't say intimidated, but I was like, okay, he's a force to be reckoned with. But you were my buffer for him. Like, I could say, it's like, you know, you were like, Yeah, you know, and I would get into a fight with Eric, which happens often. And you were always the one who would go, here you go, Chris. Come on. It's okay. Listen, he's right about this. Here's how you do this. Next time that happens, you do this. And you sort of like helped me understand how to communicate with him.
Right.
And I became really good friends with him too at the same time. Right. So,
well, I speak Eric and he speaks me.
Yeah, so, you know, it's like we. Yeah, and you guys have known each other for.
Well, we've known each other from the very beginning.
So we're talking about 20 plus years, right?
20 plus years. Yeah, yeah. I've known Eric since probably November of 1992.
Right.
And you know, up until fairly recently, we've worked pretty much continuously with each other for that length of time.
Right. Yeah, and he's a very, very strong person. So when did he go to DD and then you went with them, or did it,
how no,
did
so that's actually another interesting story that
yeah.
So when we were at Amblin doing Sequest, which was a Steven Spielberg executive produced project.
God, that's why it was Amblin.
That's why it was Amblin.
Yeah.
I don't even think Steven did it directed any episodes. He was more of a like an EP. Okay. Actually, you know who directed the pilot episode was what's this director who did Empire Strikes Back?
Empire Strikes. Oh, the director.
The director of Empire Strikes Back
is the English guy.
Yes,
I forgot his name.
Anyway, he directed. I should know his name. He's very famous.
Yes.
He directed the pilot episode of it.
Okay.
And one of the
Sequest.
Of Sequest, okay. Yes. And one of the cool things that we got to do when we were on that show was we got to go into the Amblin screening room. So it was myself and Eric and the rest of the crew. Mm-hmm. So it was probably about 15, 20 of us. Mm-hmm. And we got to sit with Irving Kirshner. That's his
Irving
name.
Irving Kirshner.
Yes. So we got to sit with Irving Kirshner in Steven Spielberg's private Amblin screening room and watch Empire Strikes Back.
Wow.
It was really cool.
Wow.
So, and the reason, I'm still not quite sure why I think he just kind of wanted us to get the idea of the kind of flair that he was looking for is from a visual perspective.
Okay.
But anyway, I'm sidetracking. When Sequest was canceled, originally we thought we were going to become like an ILM South. So we thought that, mm-hmm. that regardless of whatever Sequest did,
so it's going to be like Lucas has ILM and
Steven was
going to
have, and we even called it Amblin Imaging.
Really?
And we had, because originally we were just Sequest CGI. Mm-hmm. And then we had business cards made up and we actually had a management structure that Amblin helped us put together. And it really felt like we were going to become this visual effects company based in Los Angeles.
Right.
And then when Sequest was canceled, I think the thing was, is that Amblin decided that they probably didn't really want to be in the visual effects business. And Steven, well, he wants to make his movies.
Right.
So even though we had some other TV series and things that we were working on, it wasn't really enough Sequest was really the thing that kept the place going.
Right.
And when Sequest was canceled, all of a sudden it was like, well, you know, they probably don't want to keep this venture going anymore. Mm-hmm. As fate would have it though, about a year before Amblin closed, I was asked by John Parento, who was one of the general managers of Amblin, if I wanted to go to Japan and speak at a conference called Innerbee.
Innerbee?
Yeah.
Okay.
Innerbee is Japan's version of NAB.
Oh, okay.
So basically the thing is he kind of was offloaded it to me because I don't think he wanted to go. He was too busy, you know,
doing things
at Amblin. So I wound up going. Mm-hmm. No idea what I was going to talk about. I wrote my speech on the airplane on the way over. And what I talked about was visual effects in television.
Okay. Seems logical.
So, of course, it's what I know at the time.
Right.
So I get there, and there's two other speakers. One of them is another visual effects supervisor whose name escapes me, but he worked for R. Greenberg Associates.
Okay.
And the other one was a well-known individual who you've had on your show here.
Scott Ross.
Who was, yes.
Lucky guess.
General manager, or the president and general manager of Digital Domain.
Right, right. Well, he's a Japanophile guy.
Yeah. And he loves Japan too. Yeah. So he was at that conference. In fact, we were speaking at the same time.
Uh-huh.
So I got up first. The gentleman from R. Greenberg got up next, and then I was last.
Okay.
And, or maybe it was the other way around. But anyways, that's where I met Scott.
Okay.
And so, of course, because, you know, the way the Japanese treat their guests, is mm-hmm. they take you out and they wine and they dine you all the time. And mm-hmm. so I was always with Scott and...
Right. So it was a group of you.
So it was like a group of us that were going to sushi restaurants and drinking sake and this mm-hmm. and that. And mm-hmm. and so as we were leaving, Scott says to me, he says, hey, you know, it's nice meeting you. And if you ever want to, you know, come to Digital Domain and I'd love to show you around the place. I'm like, great. So get back to LA and I send him an email and say, hey, you know, if you want to have me come down and take a look at the place, I'd love to come down. He's like, yeah, come on down.
So this is probably about 1995?
This would have been probably 94-ish.
Okay.
Early, probably like the either late 93 or early 94.
Okay.
And so I come down and he shows me around. They were working on Apollo 13 at the time.
So this is early days.
This is early days, yeah. Yeah. They had just finished True Lies, of which they...
It was the first one.
Which is their first one, yeah. Yeah. And so he showed me around and... at that point, he actually offered me a job.
Wow.
And
so is this even before Ed was there? Mm-hmm.
No, Ed was there.
Ed was there? Okay.
93.
Yeah.
93, okay.
Ed was one of the, I think Ed was employee number two, actually, or something like that.
Yeah. I've had Ed on, too. Yeah.
He was up there.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, Ed was there. So he was kind of doing what he was doing when I came. He was vice president of commercials, I believe, or executive producer of the mm-hmm. commercial division. And so, he offered me a job at the time and I politely declined the offer because I was at Amblin at the time.
Right.
And so fast forward now a year later, our show gets canceled
mm-hmm.
and there's a whole bunch of us now who are out of a job.
Right.
And so,
call Scott and go, hey, by the way, remember that offer?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So one of my coworkers says, hey, you know, he kept poking at me saying, call Scott Ross. And so I finally called Scott Ross and I remember Mark Loaf at the time was his assistant, I guess mm-hmm. you'd call it. Yeah. And so I left a message on Mark's phone mm-hmm. saying, hey, introduced myself mm-hmm. who I was. I've been down there before. Scott offered me a job. I'd like to know if that offer still on the table. Oh, and by the way, I've got five other artists who also need a job.
Right.
And so he, like within 5 minutes,
awesome,
the phone rings
yep.
and it's Mark. And he says, hey, we'd love to talk to you. Why don't you guys come on down?
Okay.
So initially it was just myself and one other person who went down and we talked to them and they said, yeah, we'd love to, you know, explore having you guys come down. And then they eventually hire all of us down there
mm-hmm.
and they brought us in on a 90-day trial period. And what we did was we had a relationship at the time with a company called Carrera Computers and they made DEC Alpha machines.
Oh, right. The DEC Alphas. Yeah.
And then of course we also had our relationship with NewTek still at the time mm-hmm. who made Lightwave. And so we actually arranged to have Carrera Computers donate workstations for all of us with PVR playback machines in them, which remember the PVR was the only yeah. way that you could really play stuff back at the time.
Yeah.
And then NewTek provided us all the software.
So you got, well, first of all, you should explain because DEC Alphas were a big deal back
they
then.
They were a really big deal back then.
Explain what they were because people made, you know, there's some young folks they out here. Were,
that. Well, there was basically
it was another processor.
There were four kinds of machines back then. So when we were at Amblin, we used Amigas, right. Amiga 2000s.
Yes.
And it had the 040 graphics card in it with 32 megabytes of RAM.
Right.
And that was the hot rod for its time.
Yes. 32 megabytes.
32 megabytes. Yes. Stuff were in megabytes back then, not gigabytes.
Right.
Megabytes.
Yeah.
So, and we all had, we each had two workstations on our desk. So we'd be modeling on one
yep.
and then rendering on the other. And when that render was done, we would then render on the machine we were modeling on and switch over and start modeling or texturing or doing whatever it was on the other one.
Right.
And we were all Jones back then. There was no specialization. You just right. kind of did everything.
Right.
So, but then
the Amigas.
Towards the end of our run at Amblin,
mm-hmm.
We got hooked up with this company, Carrera Computer, and we were complaining to the management saying, hey, look, guys, if you wanted to build a real facility here, we need real equipment.
Right.
And at the time, I think we had 64 Amiga 2000s on a render farm set up on metal racks in a room.
Right.
And they agreed to swap out each one of those machines with a DEC Alpha. Now, the DEC Alpha was a RISC-based processor.
It was huge.
Which was a
massively
massive amounts of power. Like one DEC Alpha was worth like 20 Amigas from a render power perspective.
And also the cost was really expensive too.
It wasn't too bad. I remember they were like about 10 grand per box or something like that. And that had 64 megabytes of RAM.
Right.
Megabytes.
Yes.
And it was like 133 megahertz or something like that.
Yeah, which was a lot faster.
Because you're coming off a 40 megahertz machine with 16 megabytes of RAM. Right. And all of a sudden you got one box. And because it was a RISC processor, you couldn't compare megahertz to megahertz. It processed stuff faster.
Right.
Than just your standard.
I even remember the heat sinks on those things.
Oh, yeah. They were crazy.
Like, they were like a shoebox size.
Yeah. Yeah. And so anyway, we came to Digital Domain with Carrera, and they supplied each one of us a workstation.
So the free workstations.
Free workstations. And we got those Sony reference monitors, those little 13-inch Sony broadcast monitors.
Oh, yes, yes. The real ones.
The real ones, yeah. Yes.
The ones, not the normal monitors. The ones you use for actual reference.
The ones you use for actual reference, yeah.
Well, those are expensive.
And those, yeah, they were like $5,000. I mean, they're crazy. And we each had one of those. And so Didi, from their perspective, it was a no brainer because it's like, okay, we're going to pay their salaries, right. But they're providing their own equipment, their own software. And all we have to do is hook them into our network and then we'll just see what happens. And if 90 days it works out, we'll bring them on permanently.
What were they going to put you on?
Well, we had our choice.
Interesting.
So they said, okay, what do you guys want to do? And so they had, because they had needs for both, they had their commercial division at the time. Mm-hmm. And so some of us decided to go into commercials. Mm-hmm. And then some of us, like myself, mm-hmm. Thought, you know what? I'm tired of doing television. I've been doing television for 3 years now. I want to work on a feature. So mm-hmm. I went on to Titanic, which is what was gearing up at the time. Mm-hmm. And they put me on water R&D. And so I was doing water R&D for like 6 months.
Oh, wow.
And it didn't work out. In the end, another package called Arete.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
Won out in the end. Right. And so they wound up going with Arete. And I kind of learned after 6 months that I was fidgety at that point because it's like I was used to the fast pace of television.
Yep.
And I wasn't used to working on like one thing for 6 months. And I thought it's like I'm going to blow my brains out if I can't stop doing the same thing all the time.
Right.
And so at that point, I started working on some commercials.
Okay.
And that was where actually I met Victoria Alonso for the first time.
Right.
Because Victoria Alonso was my producer
on
the first commercial that I worked on at Digital Domain. It was a Carnival Cruise spot.
Right.
And so that was my first introduction with working with her.
So for those listening, what you can do is if you watch any Marvel movie right now and you see the credits go at the beginning or at the end, executive producer Victoria Alonso
was
one of the first executive producers because she is the main person in charge of all visual effects for all Marvel movies.
Yep.
So she's a big, big deal in this industry.
Yeah, she was my first producer at Digital Domain.
Wow.
And anyway, but that was how we all came to Digital Domain. I don't need to go blow by blow on all the projects.
No, it's fun. This is awesome.
But that was how we went from that we eventually became what was known as the NT group at Digital
NT
Domain.
NT because Windows NT.
Because it was Windows NT, and that's what they call us. Because at the time, the whole backplane of DD was
SGIs.
Was SGIs and Unix.
Yep.
So, and we were all Windows based, and so at the time there was like this sort of like friendly rivalry mm-hmm. between the Windows NT guys and the Unix guys. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they would sometimes jokingly refer to us as play school, you know, because it's like our interfaces had pretty pictures and, you know, theirs was all, you know,
knobs and
text-based.
Right.
And, you know, they had to type, you know, long lines of commands to do anything. And we would just click on stuff, you know? Right. So, you know, there's pluses and minuses to both.
Yeah. I remember when I first came to DD, it was Day After Tomorrow, and there was a bunch of guys that were coming from the NT group mm-hmm. that were there, and it was like Randy Sharp and who was somebody else? There were several of them, but they all were like the Lightwave guys, and so that was the big difference. But
right.
It was always, but it had always been some. Here's the thing that was interesting because it always been a kind of rivalry, which sometimes fun and sometimes not fun. Sometimes bitter fights at DD about the two different.
There would be, but it was kind of more. I think it was more along the lines of like, at the end of the day, it comes down to how creative is your thinking on solving a problem.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that we learned when we worked at Amblin back in the early days when we were all on Amigas, mm-hmm. because the software wasn't very sophisticated, but we still were tasked with doing what at the time were sophisticated things. Mm-hmm. And so we would have to come up with these like end run arounds to try to get something done.
Right.
Whereas on the more high end package sides, mm-hmm. package side, which is what most of the people at DD were used to using, they either had people who could program this stuff for them because there was a big software department at DD at the time. Or they had equipment and outside help that could you know solve the problem for them. And so we kind of prided ourselves at the time of being able to sort of solve these problems by just sort of coming up with a solution that was so far outside the box that nobody thought of it.
Right.
And there's good things to that and there's bad things to that too.
Right. But I think what I remember is, you know, during Benjamin Buttons, for example, that was when suddenly a lot of people from the commercial side or the NT group or what mm-hmm. used to be the NT group came out and started working on a major feature film, right? And then that continued on Tron. And then I think that's when the barriers was just broken. Like, then that was the first time that I felt that DD is like, there's no real difference between commercial and features because the pipelines were even merging completely at that
right.
point.
And that started on Star Trek Nemesis too, I remember.
Really?
Yeah, because I remember that Jay Barton was a big commercials guy at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that he really wanted to kind of, you know, broaden his horizon a little bit. He didn't just want to do commercials. He really wanted to work on features and he really wanted to work on Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And so they used the commercials workflow for stuff that he was doing on Star Trek at the time. And so
right.
I think that predated Benjamin Button.
Yes, it did. You're right. And didn't part of... wasn't there part of an X-Men thing that was done at DD that was also part of a Lightwave thing? And I'll tell you why I remember that. It was the Statue of Liberty. Because I was working on Day After Tomorrow on the Statue of Liberty mm-hmm. island part that gets flooded.
Right.
And I inherited the actual statue. I didn't model the Statue of Liberty. It was already modeled by the Lightwave guy. So I had to bring in a Lightwave model.
That could have been a Randy Sharp model.
It probably was. Yeah, it probably could have been a Randy Sharp model. Yeah, yeah. So it was kind of like this thing that was going on. But so you were a commercial guy for many, many years there, right?
I was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think when I first started there, I worked on Titanic. Then I jumped onto some commercials for a while.
Right.
And then I remember that they needed some help on Fifth Element. Or maybe it was the other way around. I was on Titanic. I was tired of doing water. I wanted to change.
Right.
And I remember that Karen Galikas, who was the mm-hmm. The digital effects supervisor or CG supervisor on Fifth Element,
yep.
Asked, you know, she knew that Eric and I could like knew how to model stuff fast,
right?
And so they gave us the task of building all of these cars, and we built like probably two dozen of these little cars. We were knocking like 2-3 cars out a day.
Wow.
And then eventually what happened was, is that I remember Mark Stetson, who was the visual effects supervisor on it. He really liked the way that, because Eric had a car background, he really liked the way that Eric was lighting the cars. And we had some really cool, there was a guy named Steve Worley who was a,
not the Worley from the Worley plugins. And
yes.
Oh, the same guy? The Lightwave Worley guy?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And I was going to say, it would be a disservice to call him the Lightwave plug-in guy because his background goes way
beyond that. He's a reckon.
He actually used to, it's a funny Steve Worley story.
Yeah.
When we were working at Amblin, and even when we were working at early days of Digital Domain, I used to have him write plugins for me.
Yeah.
And he used to love coming down to LA because he used to live up in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And for all I know, he still does. But he used to come down to LA often.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes he would, you know, stay at my house because you need a place to crash. And I would say, hey, I need this plugin that could do this or that or whatever. And then he made a deal with me. He says, all right, listen, I'll write you a plugin. You just got to give me $20. And I'm like, okay, okay. $20. Here's $20. And right. What he would do is he'd get on his laptop and he would write these plugins on the airplane on the way back to San Francisco.
Wow.
And by the time that he got back to San Francisco, he'd email me my, you know, whatever it was, .p
right.
plugin that I would need. And then we would use these plugins at DD.
Right.
And then what we would do is that we would in the marketing when these spots would go out
yep.
and we would, you know, we talk about what Steve Worley plugins we were using, mm-hmm. that would get the word out about Steve Worley plugins. Then he eventually packaged all these plugins up into a package called the, and he named them after obscure US presidents, like the James K. Polk collection or something okay. like that. And he'd sell these things and he made so money
really,
selling yeah. these plugins, but that's where these plugins all sort of originated from, was stuff that we just helped
random
him,
stuff that you needed,
stuff that we needed at Digital Domain.
Yeah. Oh wow, I didn't know that. Didn't he do the, what was the renderer that he wrote? He wrote a renderer.
Yes, right? It was called F-Prime.
F-Prime.
And it was a sort of standalone clone of Lightwave. It was a very stripped down version of what Lightwave could do.
But it did it in as real-time feedback.
It did it as real-time. And I remember at the time,
yeah.
everybody at DD was amazed that this could happen. I mean, to the best of my knowledge, I still haven't seen something that's quite as elegantly fast as that thing was for right. what it did at the time.
Well, a lot of the new real-time ray tracers now that are kind of coming out, the ones, you know, the V-Ray GPU and Redshift and all those things, they are pretty sophisticated, but F-Prime was way ahead of its time.
It was way ahead of its time. And we actually used it in I remember in a commercial one time I did with Jay. It was a Mercedes spot
mm-hmm.
that was directed by Carl Rinch. And it was this like funny spot where there was a Mercedes and it was like a play.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mercedes was on the stage. The Mercedes never moved. It just sat there and all the set pieces moved around the Mercedes.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember that spot. And opera, that's right. And there was this close-up shot of the grill of the Mercedes and we couldn't render it in, I don't remember what we were rendering at the time. I think it was just Lightwave.
Probably, yeah.
And we couldn't get the darn thing rendered without any noise on it in a reasonable amount of time. And so what Jay did is he just fired it off an F-Prime, mm-hmm. and F-Prime had this thing at the time where you could say like, okay, it was like a progressive renderer.
Yeah, yeah.
And you say, okay, after, you know, 10 minutes, move on to the next frame. Because otherwise, before it used to sit there.
Right.
And it just kept refining and refining and refining and refining. Mm. And we come in the morning, and we had these beautiful renders of this car.
Right.
And it was just one machine that was rendering this silly
right.
thing.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, recently, we there's a lot of those features have come back in V-Ray, and these are things that I've been mentioning it in some ways. Not that I'm not giving myself credit, but it's specifically like stop rendering after 10 minutes.
Right.
You know, that's great. And the other thing that V-Ray can now do, which F-Prime did way before that, is that it could resume that rendering.
Right.
So F-Prime could say, all right, I'll keep going, right? Mm-hmm. So the cool thing is that you could set it up so it'd render the whole animation.
Right.
In a noisy, grainy way after a minute, but then go back and keep refining, and it'll be as good. You're going to have the whole thing at some point done tomorrow.
Right.
So it was pretty, yeah, it was amazing. It was really cool.
Yeah, and these were like I talk about the early days where like this stuff hadn't really been done before.
Right.
And we all, you know, it's like, okay, you know, we're all, you know, we were all relatively young and none of this stuff had been done before. And it had this sort of feeling of, it was exciting, I guess, yeah. is a good way. I mean, it's as exciting as rendering can be.
Do you think it's not as exciting now, or do you think it's just different?
I think it's different now. And maybe it's just because I'm older and I've done more and I've seen more and it doesn't have the same sort of newness to it.
Right.
But I guess that's to be expected.
But you're not on the box that much anymore, are you?
No, I'm not. I mean, like, I'm on the box on a job right now just because, you know, it's They got something for me to do and I don't have another booking at the moment, but
right.
But the one thing that still to this day I find just as exciting as when I started doing this 20 plus years ago is I still get excited about coming in the morning and looking at the renders.
Yeah.
That's something that still, it's like, if it wasn't for that, I probably would be doing something else right now.
Right.
Because
you can't wait to see what happens.
I can't wait to see. I still in the morning. Sometimes I'll even log it at night from home. Sometimes before I go to bed and just, you know, check my renders and just one to make sure that something's not blowing up, and then right. two, or check other people's renders.
Right.
Just to look at it. And it's like, you know, what does it look? It's almost like Christmas
right.
every morning, you know, where I come in and it's like, I'm going to unwrap this gift. And sometimes I'm just amazed at what I see. And it's like, wow, that looks like that because people understand the process of what it takes to get there.
Yeah.
And they have enough artistic sensibility to know to do this and not that.
Right.
And because nothing, as you know, when you do this stuff happens, happenstance. I mean, sometimes right. it does, but generally speaking, a really great render and a really great result is the result of careful planning.
Yeah.
And understanding that all these abstract building blocks that we put together mm-hmm. are actually going to produce something in the end that is going to be what everyone's looking for. And if you can see how all this stuff is going to line up as you're putting it all into the system, and then you hit the submit to farm button, and then you know that, okay, I'm going to come in 10 hours tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
Fingers crossed it's going to look good. Because if it doesn't,
yeah,
you got a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, we've had a few of those where like, that render suddenly took 20 hours. What did we do wrong?
Right.
Yeah. It's true. So can you say anything about some of the stuff you've been doing recently since I've been gone? I guess you can't talk about some. Can you talk about stuff you've done like 2 years ago?
I think it was in, what was it, 2014-ish?
Yeah, it would have been 3 years ago.
Yeah, so 2014-ish, we got a phone call from George Murphy, I believe. He was a visual effects supervisor for a television series called Outlander
mm-hmm.
Over at Reliance in Burbank.
Yes.
And the Reliance Burbank office was closing.
Right.
And they needed somebody to pick up.
Okay, now I remember this. Yes.
Sales.
Yeah.
Black Sales.
Oh, I'm getting there.
Okay.
the show was Black Sales.
Yeah.
And so they...
Black Sales, it's amazing. It's,
right.
It's like a Game of Thrones with pirates and ocean stuff.
Right,
it's
right,
amazing.
Right. Yeah, yeah. It was a fantastic series.
Right.
And so... anyway, they needed somebody to come and do this work. And so we got a call from him and, or actually we got a call from Eric Henry, who was the client side visual effects supervisor.
Yep.
And so based on George's recommendation. And so we wound up finishing up the back half of season two.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a great experience with them. Aladino Diebert, who's our one of our visual effects supervisors and creative directors in mm-hmm. the commercial division. He was the one who took the job, helped bring the job in,
mm-hmm.
and I teamed up with him at the time because I was again for me it was just the luck of the draw. I just happened to be free at the time because I wasn't on something else.
This has to be one of the first times that DD did TV broadcast stuff, right?
It is. I don't think it's the Well, actually, yeah, it probably kind of is.
Yeah.
We took this thing on, and we wound up having a great relationship with Stars and with Eric Henry, who was the Star size supervisor, mm-hmm. and we actually I believe that the work actually got some VES nominations. We didn't win.
I don't know. This was what, 2014, 15?
This would have been the beginning of 2015 when we went to the...
Okay. I may have been a judge for the VES that year.
Well, there you go.
So, and I think I saw it. And I was really, really impressed. Because I knew that you know, DD had worked on some stuff on it. And I was like, oh, shit, this is really nice, you know. And it's gorgeous. It's really great work. And in fact, I even think that I forgot who it was from DD, but someone from DD came to SIGGRAPH and we have our V-Ray days and gave a talk about it.
There. That would have been Matt Dugan probably.
Yes, exactly who it was, Matt Dugan.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful. I mean, the compositing work, the lighting, the work on the sails and the ropes and the mm-hmm. all of that. And it was, again, it's one of those things. You got to figure it all out, right?
Right. And so because we developed a good relationship with them, and it was a it was a very rewarding job all around.
Yep.
They allowed us to bid on a season three, specifically an episode where the crew of the Walrus, which is the ship that they're all on, gets trapped in a storm.
Right. I think that's what Matt presented.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was it was episode two of season three.
Okay.
And so we had about 98 shots that we had to do.
Wow.
And I remember at the time I walked into Eric Barber's office at the time, and I said, you know, I'm about ready to do the hardest thing I've ever done. And he goes, well, it's not worth doing if it isn't the hardest thing you ever done.
That's such an Eric response. <It's>,
yeah. And so I said, yeah.
How much time did you guys have?
They gave us, they were very generous with their time.
Okay.
So we started, I think that by the beginning of February of 2015, we had the job awarded, and they didn't want us to just do the visual effects. They also hired us to do like 12 ships, like build 12 ships.
Okay. So asset building.
So asset building.
Yeah.
And we had to then deliver those ships to other vendors that were, that were also commissioned by the production. So we spent the first 3 or 4 months building those ships, and Kathy Dugan, who's Matt's wife, who's a fantastic modeler and texture artist.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
She and Brian Creasy, who's also at, at Digital Domain, they built and texture mapped pretty much all the ships.
Wow!
And they did a great job. And then Matt did all, of course, all the shader work, because the, you know, Matt's a fantastic look dev artist in V-Ray. And so and then after that was done, it was just like, okay, how are we going to do this storm? Because the storm had, you know, like 80-foot waves, and it had, we had to do wind effects and you know, rain effects and you know, breaking waves and all this crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And, but after, it took us, I think that by September, October of that year, we got it all out the door.
Yeah.
And, in the end, it wound up, garnering us an Emmy nomination as well as, as some VES noms. So
yeah, I remember seeing pictures of you at the Emmys.
That's right.
Yeah. That was, that's awesome. I mean, that's a great project. And
that was a great project. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad you could talk about that, because I know you're also working on a bunch of projects that are still under wraps or whatever. And it's hard to talk about that, but, that's cool. I do want to sidetrack with a little story that we can talk about, which is how I ended up hanging out, at your pool with 16 models.
I think it was more than that.
There was a lot of, yes. So this is an interesting thing. Just, and some people will know the story. So I was going to do this short, which a lot of people know, which is V-Ray IRL short, right? And we needed a location to have some kind of a resorty pool look to it, right? And I said, I know just the guy.
Because you had been there before.
I'd been there before. It goes, it's like, if we can't get the grotto, we just have to go to Greg T. Garden's house, because it's...
If we can't get the grotto,
next,
well,
it's the
grotto
next best thing.
the grotto won't come to us. We'll go to the grotto.
Right. So I said, we're going to do it. And you said, sure, you can do it. Because, you know, I'd been to your pool. It's amazing. It's literally, his pool is incredible. It's a beautiful area, lush garden. And it's awesome.
A lot of commercial overtime paid for that.
Yeah, I'm sure. But it's a great place. And so I said, he said, sure, you can do it. And then we didn't really know when we were going to shoot, but
right.
it's like suddenly we said, all right, we're going to try to do it this Saturday. I was like, hey, Greg, can we do it this Saturday? We only need about a half day there. And he said, I can't do it really. I don't know, because Chris Blythe is going to come over and he's shooting a rap commercial, and he's got about like—
No, music video.
Music video. That's right. It was a music video. It's a rap music video, right?
Right.
And he's going to have about 25 models in bikinis here.
Oh, darn.
I said, hold on, what? And so I got in touch with Chris and said, hey, can I piggyback on your production and like steal some of your models for a couple of shots in a short? And he goes, yeah, sure. Let's do it.
Yep.
And so it was in your backyard.
Yep.
It was in your backyard that we did that.
And then I remember that you needed to have for some, I don't remember what the reason was.
Yes, because we were going to be in Brazil.
That's right.
So the location was Brazil, and these models who were awesome. And I spoke to the producer who was producing the music video, and she helped me like pick the two best models that could feel the most Brazilian.
Feasibly be Brazilian.
Brazilian, right? Yeah. So this beautiful, beautiful black girl and this other girl with dark hair features. Right. And it was just perfect. It's like, these are Brazilian girls, right? It's like, you got it all represented here. But they didn't speak Portuguese.
Right.
But you're—
As luck would have it.
As luck would have it. Tell me.
My wife's Portuguese.
Your wife's Portuguese.
But she's not Brazilian Portuguese, and there is a difference.
There is a difference.
But who's going to be the wiser?
Who's going to be the wiser? So she ends up teaching these models how to say the lines in the thing. And there were two problems. One is they didn't really sound correct. And there was too much noise of the actual music video being shot in the background.
But didn't you just kind of run with it and you're like, they're at a resort.
Yeah, they're at a resort, something like that. Yeah. And I was like, that's an error. And it was like, I can't really do that. So I was like, we're going to have to ADR this. So Dan Thron, we were just talking about, goes back to your house and has your wife ADR the lines.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yes. So it's your wife's voice that's speaking Portuguese.
Right.
Of two different people. So not only did she nail it, because the lip sync was perfect, by the way. It's perfect. No one can really tell. Not only did she nail it, but she sounded like two different people.
Yep.
Like she basically changed her voice so that it could totally be two different people. It was amazing.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. It was fun. Those are some good memories.
There's tons of that stuff in the over the years.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure you've had lots of fun parties at your pool. Yeah. And how about how's your solar system working out? I'm curious about that. Can you talk about your solar system?
Of course. I'm just the look on your face was funny.
I'm just curious because you talk about your solar system at your house and you're like.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I don't, it's the novelty of it has worn off now. But
really?
When I first put it in, I would go out and I made a spreadsheet where I could take the, because when you put this in,
I'm asking you, the way you would post this back on social media about like the efficiencies of your thing. And I was looking at the way you were analyzing your solar panels was like you were looking at renderings and seeing how well they're performing.
Right.
But I mean, you're getting great performance out of your solar.
No, yeah. I mean, I figured that I probably, living in Los Angeles and you know, it's hot out here and I have a, let's face it, I have a house, Freudian slip, that consumes a lot of electricity.
And you're in the valley and it's hot.
And I'm in the valley and it's hot. So, you know, it's not uncommon in the summertime to, you know, get over in triple digits.
Right.
So I put these things in and it definitely makes a difference. I'm not doing as well as like one of my coworkers. You know, he has panels on his roof and he has a zero bill. I haven't been able to achieve that, but it's probably because I have an electric car. And it takes.
Do you have a Tesla?
It's a faux Tesla.
It's a faux Tesla. What's a faux Tesla?
So it's a RAV4 EV.
Oh.
And so
did you give up your BMW?
No. Yeah.
Really?
I did. Yeah, I gave it up.
Okay. You like your electric car?
I like it. I have to. I have to give it back in at the end of January.
Oh, it's leased.
It's leased. Yeah.
Okay.
But
aren't you on the list for the Tesla 3?
I am, but I don't know when that's.
I don't know when it's going to be.
I actually saw one last night driving up the 405.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, because I'm supposed to get mine in January, but I don't think that's happening.
Well, do you have an actual?
No, I don't have an email.
I don't either.
No, but I basically went to the website and you enter your reservation code and it'll say, you should get one between January and March.
That's what mine says too, January to March.
Yeah, it's not happening.
And so, but anyway, it's the one I have right now. The car I have right now, it's a base model Tesla. It's a base model S.
Okay.
With as far as the underpinnings go.
Right.
With a 2012 RAV4 strapped to the top of it.
So Tesla made part of it, and
yes,
Ford made the other part of it.
No, Toyota made the other part of it.
Toyota. Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
It's a compliance car.
Cool. What's the range on it?
About 120 miles.
Okay. It's a great daily driver, though.
It's great. It's a great daily driver because as you know, I live in Studio City.
Yeah.
And as you know, Didi's in Playa Vista.
Yep.
And as you know, the 405 is a mess in the morning.
Yep.
And as you know, the carpooling gives you some
advantage. Oh, and you get you have a sticker?
Yeah, white stickers.
Such an LA thing that we talk about traffic and stuff.
I know.
Yes, and I do go off on tangents all the time, so it's fine. But that's cool. That's cool. It's so good to see you. We haven't, you know, we used to hang out literally every day all the time, and it's been a while since we've hung out.
I feel like we haven't talked enough industry. We've been talking about my car. We've been talking about my pool.
We've talked about the industry. We talked about your career. Talked about DD. Well, DD's changed a lot now. It's really big. Obviously, you guys are opening new offices, and I saw you, there was some announcement of you guys opening an office in India somewhere, right? That just came out.
Yep.
So still growing quite a bit. And I know Jay's been traveling to some of these new offices.
Yep.
Have you been traveling in much?
No, not in that capacity.
Okay.
No, I mean I've been. There's really no reason for me to travel right now.
Okay.
I mean, I traveled a lot on behalf of DD over the years. I mean, working on commercials. I mean, one of the nice things about this career is that it's afforded me to go, like, I've been to Japan twice.
Yep.
You know, I've been able to go to, you know, of course, Vancouver a number of times just because of, you know, that's where the action is.
Right.
I've been to London. I've been to Prague. I shot a beer commercial in Prague one time.
Oh, right.
And
was that a Carl Rensch commercial?
No, that was not. But I did go there with Chris Fieldhouse, though. So that's always a good time.
Yes.
And you know, London, I did with that was a Carl Rensch job with Jay and Chris.
Okay.
And boy, I've got some stories on that one. And you know, it's been a fun ride. You know, originally was supposed to be a 6-month gig building models of submarines for a television series that nobody remembers anymore.
Yeah.
You know, 20 plus years ago, and here I am still, and it's was more than I ever thought it was going to be at the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you know, I was, you and I had worked a long time. I mean, obviously, when I was at DD, we worked on Tron together, we worked on Oblivion together, we worked on 47 Ronin together. I think that were you on Maleficent? I don't know if you
remember. No, I was not Maleficent.
So we worked on a lot of stuff. And Oblivion, obviously, Oblivion and Tron were huge,
right?
And we came up with some really, really beautiful images for that. So I was, it was pretty awesome. Pretty awesome. Well, that's great. We're over an hour, but, thanks so much for doing this, Greg.
Absolutely.
It's been great. So,
thank you for having me.
It'll be great. And you're always welcome to come back. Any other news you can talk about when the news is available and you can talk about it, please come back.
When the boss says I can.
When the boss says you can. Let's do that. All right. Thanks so much.
All right.